Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode. Talking today about Dolores Iborruri, aka La Passionaria, which translates into the Passion Flower of Spain. She was a woman who mobilized the masses against the rise of Spanish fascism, a woman who served as one of Stalin's right-hand women, mm-hmm. one of the first women to serve as a legislator in the Spanish Cortes, or legislator. Dolores Iborruri, again. And let me clarify the sources for today's episode up top before we even get into it.
Okay.
We have They Shall Not Pass, which is the autobiography of Dolores Iborruri, published by the International Press, I think in 1966. And then as like a more general reading of it to get more information on it, we have The Spanish Civil War by Stanley G. Payne, published by Cambridge in 2012.
Okay. And it's a, you know, Henry's done a lot of research here. He's looked into this. And the dynamic between these two books is going to be funny.
Bro, yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
It's going to be a lot.
Let's get into it.
The truth is somewhere in the middle between these two books, you know?
Yeah, between these two books. It just feels like there's it's going to be interesting.
It's just what it is.
Let's push ahead.
And then also, if you want, because there's not a whole lot of podcast source material available on the Spanish Civil War, I also listened to this podcast called The Iberian Knot that I want to give a shout out to, because he just does a really good job, and it's like 18 parts and they're like 40 minutes, so it is kind of long, but if you're looking to really just get like a thorough deep dive into the Spanish Civil War, check out The Iberian Knot.
And let's kind of preface here at the beginning of this podcast, this is for myself. This is Spanish Civil War is something I am oblique on. It's something before we got into it.
Yeah,
it's something I've never even investigated.
It's
also one of the fucking most complex subjects.
Oh, it's crazy.
You ever under you? It's crazy.
We're gonna do the best we can. We're gonna tell you what the research bore, and that's all we can say. December 9th of 1895, Dolores Iborruri is born to a mining family in Gallarta in Vizcaya, which is now known as Biscay, which is northern Spain. Her father worked in an iron ore mine, and in the latter half of the 19th century, going into the 20th century, the working classes of Spain, like the rural laborers, but also the industrial laborers and the miners, moreover, more to the point, are just becoming conscious of their class and just kind of starting to wake up and realize, like, hey, this is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
North
of Spain, beautiful country. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
I've never been.
Saw it on an Anthony Bourdain episode.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how I got all my knowledge of the world.
Bourdain. I just learned it from Bourdain. He's really good.
RP to OG.
For real, man.
Up there.
real, you know what's weird is like, that's the paradox, is he seemed to have like the best life of like go and travel the world and eat all the best food, and it wasn't enough somehow, which
nah man depression is real, dog.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing. Take care of yourself, talk to therapists. There's no shame, all right? No shame.
Yeah.
One of her earliest memories, spring or summer of 1903, there's a strike among the miners, and I think in the northern province, in Biscay for sure, but maybe around the rest of Spain as well. And like the civil guards under the monarchy are turned out, and there's like a really vicious crackdown. Like the prominent organizers are arrested, and then on the other side, like parts of the mine are blown up. And like if you're a scab, you better watch the fuck out, you know. But ultimately, the strike succeeds. At the end of October, the government, I think it's like the Minister of Government, passes a decree by which he raises the wages of the miners. So this is a success. And from 1900 to 1916, Ibaruri goes to a traditional Catholic school, and she's gradually becoming aware of the plight of the miners, even as a child, because like she knows some people who are working in the mines, like some people she used to go to school with. And she even knows people who have like, she knows like teenagers and children who have died working in the mines due to like an accident trying to diffuse some dynamite. Bonifacio, I think, is the guy's name she mentions. And there's like massive inequality between the bourgeois and the miners as well. Mm-hmm. And the industrial and rural laborers are striking, and again, just emerging from their lumpenness.
Yeah.
She marries her husband, who is a miner, at age 20, and she notes in her autobiography that once she's married, essentially this means to Spanish women that her life is complete. She need not aspire for any higher goals or aims or any position or status or whatever. She's done. She's expected to just bear his children and maybe work at the mines seasonally if they need surplus laborers to extract the ore, to get it ready for shipment and all that shit. She's like, I'm done. You know, I've won in the eyes of Spain social mores.
Yeah, this seems, yeah, that's it's fucked up.
It's very early 20th century attitude.
Yeah, it's very, it's reminiscent of like the way young males in West Texas feel after they played their last game of football. Their life's over. Their last game of high school football, life's over.
Mm-hmm. You're done. You know,
you're done. It's the same thing. Yeah.
You peaked, man.
Am I comparing the plight of women in early 20th century Spain to West Texas young kids?
Football players? Male football, teams? Yeah.
No, that'd be wrong. They have it much worse than these niggas.
It's like, a false comparison.
Yeah, it's a really false comparison, a really false, bad comparison. But this is a funny history podcast. Let's
We hope. And so in the background of all this, she begins to ask herself whether life was worth living if she's already achieved her highest state. And so she starts to read some Marxist literature, perhaps given to her by her husband, perhaps not. So 1917, the monarchy is crumbling. Spain remains neutral during World War I. They're more focused on crushing a revolt in Morocco, which I think breaks out in 1920, and Alfonso XIII is still in power. And Basque and Asturias, which are two provinces or states, if you want to think of them like that, in northern Spain, they start agitating for rebellion. And so Ibaruri and other socialists, they start stockpiling like homemade bombs in a cave because they're getting ready to just bust out this revolution, you know?
Yeah, like George Washington himself.
Basically, yeah. Just start mobilizing, just get ready for it, you know?
Let's just do it. Let's just do it.
Let's stop talking about it. You know, there's a lot of chit-chat going on. Not a whole lot of action, fellas.
Dump the tea in the harbor.
Dump
now.
The tea in the harbor. Burn your stamps.
Yeah.
Don't drink sugar. All that shit.
Yeah.
August 10th, 1917, the uprising fails, and Ibaruri and the others have to destroy all of their bombs, which I imagine was quite the ordeal if you've got like a whole little cave, full of bombs.
Isn't it literally a match?
It could have been a bad day for somebody who's just smoking a cigar or something, you know?
Just throw the cigar. And then throw the cigar. Blows up. The bombs blow up other bombs. I don't think that's the easy day.
A huge chain reaction.
Literally 5 seconds.
It'd be crazy. Yeah. And she and her husband are arrested around that time, and there's about 100 communists and just leftists generally killed after the uprising. But they hear of the October Revolution sometime in November, and they rejoice. You know, strikes actually increase throughout Spain because now they have a model to follow, particularly on the latifundias, which are like the large land holdings, rural land holdings in Andalusia and Extremadura.
Okay.
1920, Ibarruri is elected to the first provincial committee of the Basque Communist Party, which I think eventually morphs into the PCE or the Partido Comunista or Comunista de España, which is like the minority party compared to the other leftist organizations that Stalin, or which Stalin, helped establish.
Yeah.
Summer of 1921, there is some sectarianism going on. So you've got the socialists, which are primarily under this thing called the UGT, it's the Union General de Trabajadores, and then the anarchists of the FAI-CNT. I don't remember that acronym. I'm going to be real. But those
And it's all right, because you've done a lot.
thank you. Like, I appreciate any amount of leeway I can get on this episode, I will take, all right? And the way I understand anarchists, or the way I've heard it talked about, is they're not so much like, yeah, man, we're going to go fucking just bust shit up. It's more like libertarians. Like, we don't need a government, as small a government as possible, and we'll just fucking figure it the fuck out, okay?
No, it's all over the map, dude. It's like, anarcho-libertarians, uh-huh, anarcho-socialist, anarcho-communist. People apply that, and it's very, yeah.
Really confuses me. Not gonna lie. It's, you put anarcho in front, I don't know what you mean.
This is confusing. It's a lot. It's when a you lot. Start talking about the political beliefs of anarchists,
uh-huh, whew, which is kind of an oxymoron in itself.
Well, yeah, I don't know enough to say that.
I don't know enough about anarchists. Like, the political beliefs is that there should be no politics, because I'm not an anarchist, maybe. And I'm not versed in anarchist literature, and I'm not about to do the research. Yeah. I'll be real. I'm not going to do it, okay?
I don't have enough time. I'm out here trying to buy altcoins right now.
I run a small business. I'm not an anarchist, all right? Okay, and so the anarchists and the socialists are both larger than the PCE itself, but all of those three sectors of the left, they're all like courting the unions, because I recognize that that's, you got power in bodies, you know, and so that's what you want to get. And Ibarruri herself is organizing miners by like getting them registered in the ranks of the Communist Party, and also organizing strikes.
Yeah. Organized labor is the foundation of any leftist movement.
Yes.
You don't have a leftist movement without organized labor.
Yes.
So some of you niggas like, oh, we're going to take it over tomorrow, and you don't have proper unions, mm-hmm, you have supportive unions, you ain't going
to
do shit.
Also, if your employer is telling you not to form a union, fucking quit that job.
Yeah.
Find somebody who's going to respect you, okay?
All you niggas that work at Amazon, we're talking to you.
Solidarity, man. Best of luck.
Don't buy shit from Amazon. Yeah, man. It's wild.
So 1923. There is the establishment of a dictatorship under General Miguel Primo de Rivera, and he starts jailing and persecuting communists, and there's like a widespread censorship of the press during this time period. It's around the same time that Ibarruri gives birth to triplets, only one of whom survives, unfortunately.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And the family is in dire economic straits, because for the next 7 years, for the majority, I think, for all of Miguel Primo de Rivera's dictatorship up until 1930, Dolores's husband is in and out of jail, yet she's continuing to organize, because she's got, like, I think, two kids during this time period, and sometimes she's having to, like, bring her children with her to these meetings. That's how committed she is to the cause. She's like, mm-hmm, I'm not gonna stay home with them. I'm not gonna leave them home alone. So I'm gonna take them to the meetings, you know?
Yeah.
So the left is agitating for an overthrow of Rivera, and some of the problems that Spain is facing during this time period. You have rampant inflation, and Rivera also never addressed the problem of land reform. He never broke up those latifundias, and so people are still starving and still downtrodden and still not making enough money to better themselves. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of tensions and a lot of inequality that needs to be addressed.
It's interesting because people always have, like, there's a lot of governments that have land reform in their, like, a distribution of wealth in their, like, their constitution or whatever, like their thesis or whatever, mm-hmm. and then, like, woo, never gets done.
Never gets done, man. You campaign on it.
He's looking at you, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
they came to power. Everybody's talking about land reform. We're gonna do all this stuff. Nothing.
That's how you campaign, though, man. You just make a bunch of promises that you cannot keep, and then people are like, "Oh, wouldn't it be nice if he did that?" And then you elect him on the idea that it might be mm-hmm, nice mm-hmm. if he maybe did that, and then he doesn't, and then you feel like a fool. You're like, "Well, and then that's just politics, you know."
And then when I take that land, my fucking self by the barrel of a gun, I'm the bad guy.
And
now.
Then when I start stockpiling bombs yeah, in a cave,
I'm a bad all of a guy. Sudden, now.
I get droned. Yeah. This is fucked up, isn't it? It's fucked Come up. On,
yeah, this is that's the march of history.
That's what it. That's unfortunately, you know.
Yeah.
Ibaruri is doing her part to organize in Vizcaya against the Primo de Rivera dictatorship, and eventually he resigns, only to like go to Paris and die shortly after he resigns. Next phase that we're going to talk about, it's like a wide swath of history. April 14th of 1931 is the formation of the Second Republic of Spain, which is a Republican socialist government that lasts until 1936.
Yeah.
They have a new constitution, which is very secular, and so there are restrictions on the church. And the church is like this, you know, we're talking about Spain, which is a traditionally very Catholic nation, to where the Catholic Church is very involved in almost all aspects of life. Like Ibaruri mentioned, she talks about in her biography that there was a child who dies who hadn't been baptized. And there was like this huge stink in the neighborhood because they wanted to bury her in the local Catholic cemetery, but all the higher ups and the clergy and stuff wouldn't let that family bury their child in that cemetery because they hadn't been baptized. And that's they like run the schools and they hold a bunch of land and have a bunch of money. And
that's it's a foreign concept to us because we are Americans, and that's like specifically something that like the founding fathers. Like, this is the one thing that they did was, like, no combination of church and state.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the world, especially in Spain and kind of, you know, the Spanish colonies that, you know, grew up in nation into nation that turned into nations, a revolution. And then, like, a lot of colonies in Africa, like, they have these pillars. They have the kind of pillars of power, like military, the government. Then you might have a business pillar of power. And then, like, the fucking Catholic Church.
Type
of fucking church is just sitting there.
Yeah, it's going
to
help you out,
man. They own a shit ton of land, and you can't get elected without bowing to the fucking, making sure the Catholic Church is on your fucking side.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But
they're
that's,
like
I mean,
the historic kingmakers, you know?
I mean, but that goes all the way through history, you know?
Yeah, a longstanding religion. Moneyed power that just like, you know, we talked about on the Marcus Garvey episode with United Fruit being called El Pulpo.
Yeah.
You want to talk about a fucking
El Pulpo.
A pulpo.
Yeah.
It's a Catholic church. You know what I mean? Come on.
Yeah. You can't live with your girl. It's considered sinful.
Sinful.
If you don't pay these niggas money to marry
you. And also you talk like the whole like what is it, Martin Luther and the revolution of him just being like, hey, it's bullshit that you can just buy yourself out of sin.
Yeah.
Which the Catholic Church, they were the one who were willing to take the Lutheranism and everything.
Yeah, so I mean, you got Martin Luther. And
I have my own attitudes about the Catholic Church. And
yeah.
In line with what's.
I mean,
not, maybe not.
Yeah,
entirely
I'm not,
line,
I don't specifically
also,
just hate Catholics. That's how you get into Klan territory.
As again, don't hate Catholic. I hate most religions. Maybe not hate, but just like hate the abuses of most religions.
I realize, you know, they all have they have pros and cons.
And I
some
say this as like
have a lot of more cons.
Yeah,
than pros.
Yeah. I went to church like maybe three times when I was in my formative years. So I'm saying that from
today.
My like flimsy little background, right?
I went to church today.
Was it good?
It's good. Good. So it's a quarantine church, dog.
Oh, okay.
I'm in my bed on my phone.
And so,
all right.
That being said, with the restrictions on the church, there's also a lot of violence during the Second Republic against clergymen. Like, priests are being, like, killed in the streets, and some churches are being destroyed and burned down. And I don't want to, like, apologize for that too much, but this is basically just long-standing anti-clericalism coming to a head, and that the church is viewed as a moneyed and landed institution, historically corrupt and also intertwined with the monarchy, and there's like rampant inequality. They're viewed as this long-standing central pillar of power that is perpetuating this inequality, and so I can understand that there's a certain amount of rage there.
It's a and they are a moneyed interest, and they are the bourgeois of this, like. They are that, right? And landed interest and all that. But then also you got the dynamic of like, are they touching these kids out here?
Also that.
And you combine, all that. Those things.
You can be like, these guys are kind of bullshit, right?
Yeah, like you combine all those things, bro. Like they just keep getting transferred from province to province.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got, you know, like, and there's still the reason why you can't live with your girl and with your mom.
And they're still telling me what I should do when with my life when they're over here doing heinous shit.
Heinous
things. Okay, you get off of that fucking pedestal. Like maybe
the nastiness.
Nastiness, exactly. As a result of this anti-clericalism, there's the SEDA, which is CEDA, the Spanish, in English, the Spanish Catholic Confederation of Autonomous Rights, which is kind of like the centrist, center-right party of Catholicism, the political party of Catholicism. And they're more about, quote-unquote, individual liberty. But they mean liberty as in, like, freedom to go to church and freedom of the clergy to perform its traditional social role, the one it's always played. And their ranks start to swell due to this anti-clericalism, because especially like, you know, all of the gold and all of the material resources that have been taken from Latin America and everything, they built some fancy ass fucking churches in Spain, and now those churches are being burned to the ground, and it's like, oh, this is an attack on our national culture, even though that culture was built on third world resources.
I don't think you can really communicate how powerful it is when somebody says, yeah, man, this is the party. This is the political party, but this is the political party of God.
Like, it's rough, like, man.
Like,
it's
what?
Hard.
Word?
Say, yeah. Oh, like, wow. Oh my God. Like, wow.
Yo, Jesus is fucking committee chairman.
He's running. Jesus is running for president.
The Holy Spirit,
like, that's
is
crazy.
Doing fucking finance over
mm-hmm,
there.
Mm-hmm.
That's I don't think you could. Yeah. Like, your grandma is gonna vote for them every single time.
She's going. She's gonna orchestrate the bake sale she's gonna turn out the vote with her sweet-ass snickerdoodle cookies, all right?
Yeah.
Let me tell you that. Spain, during the Second Republic, and even after the Second Republic, I'm going to be honest, it is a clusterfuck. Like, in addition to the three parties we mentioned last time on the left, that you have the socialists, you have the communists, which Ibaruri is a part of, and the anarchists, and that's just on the left, and then you've got various parties under those three main branches, making it even more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, toward the center, toward the right, you've got SEDA, you've got monarchists who want the return of like Alfonso XIII, or like maybe monarchists who are like, yes, I need a monarchy in theory, but there'll be disagreements who that monarch should be. Mm-hmm. You've got fascists who are like, yeah, I believe in a strong man, but not necessarily a king. Maybe we need some other kind of political arrangement, which is still rooted in authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Basque and Catalonian nationalists. And Basque and Catalonia are both in like northern Spain. And those nationalists, while they believe in autonomy for their province, they also might fall under the category of any of the categories of the left or right. So there's a bunch of different competing interest going on in Spain, and it's hard to kind of to galvanize them, and it's hard to navigate that web. Moreover,
they're still Catalonian nationalists till this day.
Yes,
they're still like they're still
swinging, man.
Yeah, yeah. And again, we say all that to say this is to say this is a really difficult subject to get to understand,
to cover in one podcast. Like, come on.
That, that it's that we are not gonna hit.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say there's a lot to cover, man. Yeah. And like in the broad strokes, nobody is really happy with the Second Republic. Like the right is against it because they perceive it as leftist, and it is to an extent. But the left thinks that it isn't really leftist enough, and that they're not really dismantling the latifundias. And the primary issue is they're not like redistributing the land. They're not they're not addressing any of the issues that the left needs addressed. You know, that's going to result in equality for the masses and all this stuff. Is they're not doing any of that shit. It's and so, like, Joe Biden. Why support this?
Fucking Joe Biden president?
Like Joe Biden, man. Like,
why is this Joe Biden? You want to give me a $15 minimum wage? Okay, all right.
You want to fucking gaslight me on that bullshit, talking about like, oh, I'll do it. And then it's like, I don't know, guys. $2,000 checks and shots.
$1,400. It's okay, like, you know what? Right,
cool, bro. Whatever. All right, fine.
We have some issues.
Sure. And there are also uprisings during the Second Republic from both the left and the right. In 1932, there's a rightist uprising under this guy, Jose Sanjurjo, and I think that might have just been under some personal shit, like he didn't get his promotion or whatever. But then also amongst the left, primarily in Asturias, in October of 34, but it's like a broader uprising. Revel of 34 in Asturias, they're protesting the electoral victory of Seda, and this is what Stanley Payne is saying again.
Yeah.
And there is a very harsh crackdown by the army, primarily in Asturias, but again, it's also in other regions, by this guy, General Francisco Franco. And the crackdown is pretty brutal. Like, anybody who is associated with the right, or like anybody who's suspected, it's basically like a war of extermination. And he's encouraging his men to like rape women who are of the left, and just like, we're going to come down with the harshest hand on this rebellion. And during all this, while this is going on in Asturias, Ibaruri herself, she helps orchestrate the flight and of women and children out of the region. So she's doing her part to make sure that they're not caught up in Franco's violence.
Yeah, so Franco been a madman since young.
Bro, he got his like stripes in Morocco and everything, and it was more of the same shit that he was like encouraged to like rape women and just be a brutal asshole and kill whoever. Just very harsh shit.
Yeah, fucked up.
It's fucked up. So as far as what Ibaruri does during 1931 and 1936. The party leadership, the PCE leadership, transfers her to work in Madrid to work on the newspaper The Mundo Obrero, or Workers' World. She's arrested a couple times during the period, and she's like organizing hunger strikes to protest prison conditions inside of the prisons. And then, similar to Angela Davis, they isolate her when she starts talking to the other prisoners like about communism and everything, and starts trying to organize there. And so they're like, all right, you're going to solitary. She's also complaining about the books because they suck. It's just a bunch of Bibles and theological texts and Thomas Aquinas. Come on, man. I don't want to read Thomas. Nobody who wants to read Thomas Aquinas other than weirdos out there who are suddenly interested in spiritual warfare. Anyways.
Look, man. Bible's got some good stories in it, dog. Some good ass little tales.
Yeah, but if you hate the Catholic Church, and if you were like if you were like raised, went to school at a Catholic run institution, you're kind of like, bro, I've heard all these, man. I don't.
Yeah, no, I mean,
look, I don't want to revisit them.
I want to revisit this.
I get the gist, you know.
I want to revisit this again and again and again.
No, I'm good. And the Central Committee of the PCE in 32. Ibaruri is elected to the Central Committee of the PCE in 1932. She represents Spain at the 7th World Congress of the Comintern in Moscow, and then also tries to garner support for the Second Republic from both France and Belgium in 1935.
The Comintern, dog. Everywhere.
Everywhere. Literally everywhere. That is their whole
intent. I mean,
their
name is literally the Communist International. Yes. It is the part.
They're getting out there, man.
Explicit mission is communism spreading in nationalism.
They're doing the work.
I think
they're doing the job. Trotsky founded it. I think because that's like his whole mentality.
Who founded it?
If I remember correctly, Trotsky had like a pretty big role in establishing it. Because that's his whole vision is like, no, we just got to keep fucking shit up.
I just love that. Yeah, I love that you just have Ho Chi Minh running around, just like nobody's paying attention to him, but he's paying attention.
He's still laying low.
He's just laying low. What's his name during this time? He could be one of his 12 names.
No.
He already moved on from Wen Dan. He moved on from Wen Dan.
He's done.
He's done. He's on to something else now.
He's making those pastries, man. He's organizing while baking. Yeah. He's baking, the secret ingredient in every strudel.
Ho Chi Minh literally traveled the world. He everywhere. Yep. He was just making pastries. Mm-hmm. World class pastry chef.
World
class. People don't know that though.
People don't really. You don't really hear that a lot of the times. And the Ken Burns documentary doesn't want to talk about it.
They don't know what to talk about. They don't talk about the softer side of the man.
How we start sliding toward the Spanish Civil War, February 16th of 1936. There are, I think, general elections, and elections occur. And there are leftist mobs interfering with the electoral process. They're like destroying or confiscating the ballot boxes. And the rightists on the electoral boards where voting had to be repeated due to this either resigned or were like pressured into resigning. And then on March 1st, you get the runoff elections. And there's more intimidation going on. The results being that the Popular Front, which is the new name for like the left broadly, like anarchists, communists and socialists, whatever you are, we'll take you. We're the Popular Front now. Yeah. They get 60% of the seats in parliament, one of which goes to Ibarruri.
And in the book, the Ibarruri's autobiography, when this era like comes up, she just like, this is from Payne. Payne kind of talks about this. Yeah. And then in the book, Ibarruri
is... She's just like, oh, and she says, like, we won a landslide. And then Payne's like, there was massive amounts of rioting that resulted in electoral fraud.
And look here, dog. I don't know enough about this subject to say anymore.
I don't know. One of the first things that is done around this time is Falange, or Phalanx, founded by José Primo de Rivera, who is the son of Miguel Primo de Rivera, the dictator, is declared illegal, and so they're forced to go underground. And Phalanx, or Falange, it's basically like, I'll say it, if the Proud Boys had balls, okay? That's who that is. Is they're actually about, like, getting together and doing shit.
I mean, that is kind of what the Proud Boys, they actually do hit people and do, like, fight people a lot. Like they're actually kind of a little bit dangerous.
Daryl Talk.
No, I'm calling record. We don't have the time to dive into the Proud Boys.
You know, I call them the Sad Boys, and one time Alex called them the Good Boys, and I can't decide which I like better. I think I like the Good Boys.
I really think
boys out here, you know,
we need to stop downplaying the amount of like assaults and violence. The Proud Boys.
Yeah, they are gross.
Yeah, they're like literally gross people. Fuck them. Yeah.
May of 1936 in Asturias, she senses that things are sliding towards war. Ibarruri tells an assembly to, quote, keep your powder dry and sleep with one eye open.
That's how I sleep, dog. Gotta keep that powder dry.
Gripping your pillow tight?
No, just like, you gotta keep the flower. She's talking about guns. We're not talking about the same thing.
I'm talking about Metallica, but that's
cool. Oh, no, dog.
My hand.
And we just lost all our listeners.
Ruster never land.
People came for history. They didn't come for this history.
You know? Hey, man.
They didn't come for this history. They didn't come for you doing Metallica.
July 1st of 1936. This is getting into the second phase of her life, and I'm sorry it took so long. The second phase of her second act of her life called Bloodshed. Phalangists break into a radio station in Valencia, and they broadcast that soon a quote-unquote syndicalist revolution is going to break out. And, like, they are counterattacked, and their shit is put, like, hauled out of the radio station. There's a restaurant. In response to this, there's a restaurant called Vodka, where mm-hmm. the Falangists regularly meet, and a bunch mm-hmm. of other like casinos and clubs yeah. that are affiliated with the right are also destroyed, which yeah. basically proves their prophecy true to like centrists or like observers or whatnot, who are just like, oh shit, maybe this is the start of the revolution, even though violence during the Second Republic was pretty prevalent, you know, yeah. on both sides, I mean to say. Yeah. July 13th of 1936, Calvo Sotelo, who is a former finance minister under Primo de Rivera, is assassinated by a socialist.
Okay.
And this is like the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the breakout of the war. On July 18th of 1936, the Spanish army in Morocco rebels against the Republic. There's this guy, Emilio Mola, and Francisco Franco, as well as other top military leaders. They had long been like building a network and trying to, you know, conspiring and whatnot. And so the result of all that networking, if you want to think of it like that, is that military barracks across the country also revolt. And then behind them, they've got the support of the Falangist militias.
Mm-hmm.
Internationally, as far as the international response, the U.S. continues to sell petroleum to Franco and the nationalists. Stanley G. Payne, he mentions Texaco by name, that continues to sell to him despite the war going on.
Hey, come on, big dog. I got this oil. I got to get off my hands.
I got this oil, man.
What do you do? You want me to just sit around with the oil?
Like, I've pulled all of this oil out of the grounds of Venezuela.
Yeah.
And I need to offload it somewhere, okay? I'm sitting on a surplus, and you're not going to let me get it off, you know? Come on, man. Dope.
Look, I got to get this oil out.
You want to get reelected, don't you? Come on,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, that's...
That's it.
Yep.
FDR, he's sympathetic to the plight of the Republic, but the U.S. is the U.S. public broadly, like the citizens, are like going through their phase of isolationism, mm-hmm. of which... or from which Pearl Harbor would wake them up, of course, 5 years from now. And then in an appeal to national aid, the Spanish Republican government begins to frame itself as a peaceful government, like committed to democracy. And yeah, I mean,
look at me. It's kind of it's a complex. They definitely, once you get to this point, now it's like there's complex stories about what's going on before that. But once you get to this point, dog, it's Franco versus everybody who's not with Franco.
Yeah.
And if you are not, you got to be on the side that's against Franco.
Yeah.
Because if you on the Franco side, that's mean you on Hitler's side.
That's troubling. Mussolini side. Yes.
And that's how you get.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up at Nuremberg, right there. That's how.
So there's a non-intervention agreement signed in August and September of 1936. So like right 2 months after the war breaks out, it's primarily orchestrated by Great Britain and France, who decide to like lay off.
Yeah.
And it's also signed by Germany, Russia, and Italy, but the latter three almost immediately violate the agreement. And both Hitler and Stalin have vested interest in adding fuel, Texaco fuel, might I say, to the fire that is the Spanish Civil War, so that in Hitler's case, the world is distracted from what he's doing to maneuver in Eastern Europe and his annexation of the Sudetenland and all of his war preparation. And in Stalin's case, the internal purges of like, hey, they both want to take the heat off themselves. And so like, all right, if they're all distracted by what's going on in Spain, I'll benefit, it, you know?
Would you say a part of it is like they want to, it's also a proxy war.
Yes.
It's a proxy war. Like people are testing out, and as we see in later, I mean, during this conflict, people are testing out the maneuvers and their forces, how they'll fare in the war that's to come. Like you have the Luftwaffe and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Just doing blitzkrieg, like trying to understand.
Yeah, the Luftwaffe, I heard on the Iberian Knot, is actually the reason why Franco was able to get his forces from Morocco, where they initially rebelled, to mainland Spain, because the navy was either incapacitated or primarily sympathetic toward the left, and so they weren't able to ferry their troops across the strait because they didn't have any ships. And so Hitler was like, all right, just use my Luftwaffe.
And Luftwaffe comes in.
They Luftwaffed it up, man.
They Luftwaffed it up, and then they'd be bombing kids and children and then cities. They did
a bunch of other heinous shit. So another thing that I thought was interesting is that Spain's gold reserves are the fourth largest in the world, and like right at the time, and right as the war is breaking out, they decide that they're not really safe inside of Spain, and so they send them to Moscow.
Yeah.
And I heard that Stalin, in basically an aside to an aide, he's talking to him basically just like, oh yeah, they're never going to get that shit back.
It's in
Moscow now, man. I'm keeping it.
That is Stalin's. Oh, my man is shrewd. Let's say that. He's a shrewd fella.
He's a shrewd fella.
Let's put it that way.
It's a shrewd financial investment, sir.
I mean, that is a shrewd financial investment. It is a shrewd financial investment for me to take your money.
Totally just swindles him.
That's a very shrewd financial investment.
Yes.
For me to shoot you in your face and take your money.
Take your money, man. That's cool. If you insist, I guess. I have no problems with this.
Yeah.
So Italian support of Franco under Mussolini outweighed that of Germany. Italy lands like 70,000 troops total and advisors and officers in Spain, whereas Germany fields about 40,000. Yeah. Italy, in particular, Mussolini, viewed Spain as a potential satellite state, which like Franco's not as into, because he's like, I see what you're kind of like trying to do, but I'm not about to be anyone's puppet. I mean,
Mussolini's just thinking about, he wants to, you know, they want to make Rome great again.
Exactly.
And they want to make, and the Roman Empire was Spain. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what Germany fields most famously is probably the German Condor Legion, where this is where Hitler gets to try out a bunch of his, like, aviation techniques under the Condor Legion. And also what he negotiates for himself from Franco is not only, like, financial compensation, which Stalin gets some as well, in addition to the gold, but what Hitler wants is also like mining rights. He's all about the resources. He's like, I know you guys got raw materials, particularly in the northern provinces, and I want a cut, you know?
Look here, dog. I'm just on this mad search for oil. It's going to lead me down a path.
Meth-fueled search for oil.
And it's going to lead me down a path where I end up killing a lot of people in this place called Stalingrad.
That's right, man.
And a lot of my, and really the war turns on its face, and I ever since that point, that's when the shit craters. Uh-huh. But where's the oil?
Where's the oil, man?
I just want to imagine him like looking for, I gotta find oil somewhere. God damn it.
And then the U.S. surprised, like, takes a page out of his book and is like, where is the oil? Yeah. You know? And then you get the next 70 years of our history. Leftist militias include the 5th Regiment and, most famously, the International Brigades. Bum, 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 bum. The largest amount of international fighters or combatants come from under the International Brigades, that is, which is like it's like a branch of the Comintern, isn't it? Or like the Comintern organizes the International Brigades, I'm pretty sure.
I am not sure about that. I am not a professor of Comintern history.
Okay.
I'm just going to say that up front.
We'll get there.
The International Brigades are, from my understanding, it's not, there's a lot of people that go fight in those International Brigades. Mm-hmm. They're just like, it's like an American, like, it's like young, like, if you're like an idealistic American in 1936 and you're like of fighting age, you were like, I'm going to go fight in Spain because we're going to go fight the fascists.
Yeah.
And that's what people did.
Like, but also, like, I'm going to go fight the fascists in Spain because I'm sick of working on my dad's corn farm.
It is a lot of that.
There's also got to be some of that, you know?
That is how John Boy did do it. John Boy from the Waltons. I know you've never seen it, but
no.
He's like, I just want to see the world. I just want to do something bigger. And then he goes fights in Spain and then comes back and like lives. I'm pretty sure I forgot how he lives, but like, there's a weird part of that. I was like, why the fuck is he going to fight in Spain?
All I've seen is Iowa. Do you understand me? There's got to be more. Not even to Iowa. Life.
It was Virginia, but like the Appalachian part of Virginia.
Ugh. I don't mean to be so elitist about that. I'm sure it's very pretty if you enjoy hiking. I do not. I was born in Virginia. I got love for Virginia, but
I think his thing was like also. Oh yeah, it was his whole thing was like about the kind of fascism, like about how like it was a fighting fascism. From my remembering of the Waltons, I may be mischaracterizing the Waltons, but nobody ever really talks about it. So you should be glad I'm shouting them out on this fucking podcast.
There you go. Same thing with Iberian Knot, man. Here we are, yeah. Just niche shout outs. That's what we do. That's what we do now. Yeah. The countries that send the largest amount of troops under the international brigades is like Germany, France, and Italy, as well as like Hungarians and Polish people. And then you also have people from like Latin America and Americans. I read in the Stanley G. Payne book that a lot of the Americans that come are Jewish as well. And then just 41,000 is the number that is given by Payne as far as the amount of troops fielded under the international brigades. Some of the more famous people, and as far as like their political alliances while the Spanish Civil War is going on, Hemingway comes over and he fights in favor of the left and the Republicans. And he writes, I said, farewell to arms. That's not right. It's For Whom the Bell Tolls that Hemingway writes about the Spanish Civil War. George Orwell also fights, I think, in favor of the left. Picasso, I don't know if he fights. I know he is a leftist. And then Salvador Dali, he's in favor of the nationalists.
Okay. There was always something I didn't like about Dali.
So you see all those weird surrealist paintings where you're like, what the fuck's going on? There's a little bit of a nationalist twinge going on behind Dali. All right?
Yeah. Okay, wow.
But also, what the fuck do artists know? So maybe. I don't know.
We shouldn't say that as we're two comedians who claim to be artists. Okay.
Yeah, but we read. Right. I don't know how much Dali read, though. That's all I'm saying. There's also the Moscow textile mill. Ibaruti mentions this in her autobiography. There's this Moscow textile mill called the Three Mountains, which is sending like clothes, blankets, food, and medicine to Spanish women. And then there's also like NKVD officers floating around, some of whom are leading the international brigade, some of whom are maybe doing their own thing. You know, you never know. With those guys. What Ibaruri is doing through all this, as well as like organizing, and she's on the front lines for a lot of this. She's on the radio broadcasts, and some of her more famous quotes are, "It is better to die on your feet than live on your knees. No pasarán," which means they will not pass, or they shall not pass, which becomes like the slogan of the left during this time period. No pasarán, you know, just like Gandalf style, like, you shall not pass.
Yeah, but right? Listen, we're going to be honest.
Slaying the Balrog, man.
If we're going to be honest here, they did pass because they have the Luftwaffe backing them up. They're the Luftwaffe perfecting skills.
And Italian tanks and planes as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Early phases of the war, Badajoz, Talavera, and Toledo fall, which are all like south of Madrid, and Madrid is kind of in the center of Spain. And so the left and the Republicans, they start reinforcing the suburbs around Madrid because they know that a siege of the capital is coming. And just to give you an idea of how like personal and gritty and up close this war was, the Popular Militia, which is a Republican newspaper, they have a quote that Ibaruri cites, which is, "Every house a fortress, every street a trench, every neighborhood a wall of iron and combatants." Mm-hmm. No fucking around, right?
Yeah. I mean, dog, once you like, I don't know when urban combat starts, but urban combat is not, it's not fun.
Is awful. No, man.
Because it's like you're in a doorway.
Yeah.
It's room to room. You don't want to go onto the street because they got the street pins. You got to fucking burst through the fucking goddamn sidewall. It's a lot.
And then there's a chance that a tank will just come and bust down the wall of the house that you're posted up in. And maybe it's a friendly tank and maybe it's not. Whereas maybe like field warfare, you're like, oh, I can see around me for the most part. There's a big, open field.
I can see
at least a mile ahead of me, and I see the little specks and dots. But you got all these obstructions in urban warfare, you know?
It's just claustrophobic.
I'm saying, yeah, for sure. November 1936, the siege of Madrid begins, and the left is able to hold out for a while. They actually hang on to Madrid for quite a while. February of 1937, Franco and the Nationalists, they attempt to cross the Jarama River, which is, like, I think, southeast, or it's like, I'm sorry, southwest, or like west of Madrid. They're trying to approach Madrid from a different angle. There's a painting that I'm going to post on our Instagram, because Ibaruri is like there on the front lines, and that's the subject of the painting that I'm gonna post. Franco's trying to like take Madrid again from a different angle, and the fighting at the Jarama River is like the first time that the larger units met in battle. I think because it was more open, like we were talking about, but they are repelled, and so in response, Franco decides to focus on northern Spain rather than focus all those efforts in Madrid, because one of the provinces in northern Spain is a place called Navarre. I think it's Navarre. They have a bunch, that's like a nationalist stronghold amongst this group called the Requetes. They provide the nationalist forces with like 40,000 volunteers, which I think Payne said this is the most out of any internal Spanish province. So he knows he has allies there, and so he's like, all right, I can't get Madrid, I'm going to go north. Fuck it.
Yeah.
This gets into the third and final act of Ibaruri's life, which is From the Ashes. April 26th of 1937, Guernica in northern Spain, the province of Biscay, as part of Franco's northern front, Guernica is bombed, and this is perhaps the most famous incident of the war. Pablo Picasso makes a painting, which you should look at, called Guernica, that deals with how Spain processes the bombing, because it's like the first really badass bombing to occur.
Badass is a bad word to describe that.
It's gnarly, brutal. That's what I mean by that. Not like, oh, it was so cool. Yeah, like, you know what I mean? No, it was like awful. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's just
intense. Pablo Picasso's like a very kind of, His use of shapes and like kind of sharp edges, like kind of lines, and it almost depicts like the madness of like being bombed by the Luftwaffe again, like by the fucking
Condor Legion, man.
Yeah,
floating around. And then out of all of this, like while this northern assault is going on, May 3rd to May 8th of 1937, you've got the May Days or the May Day Revolts. And this is like, it's crazy. It's crazy to me because you have like, I read that it was either battles, but I think Ibaruri says that it was collaboration between the FAI-CNT, which is the anarchists, and the POUM, or the Partido de Obreros Unidos Marxistas, or the Party of United Marxist Workers, roughly.
Yeah.
They, like, collaborate, and they decide, this is what Ibaruri is saying, that, the Spanish left, the Republican Spain, the Republicans are about to lose this goddamn war, so let's just force collectivization and try to realize Lenin's dream of utopian 1917, 1918 Russia, which puts them in, which forces them to, you know, they're naturally conflicting with the Catalonian government because they've got their own government because they're like nationalistic and want their own independent province. Yeah. And they've got their own independent province. They've got their own government called the Generalitat under this guy, Lluís Companys. And so, and he's like a leftist, and he's trying to talk to the popular front, as it were, like the broader popular front, like the communists and everything. Yeah. And you've got these anarchists and these like Trotskyists who are just trying to launch their own revolution while a war is going on. And
I mean,
what Ibaruri says, to put it in her words, is she says that an anarcho-Trotskyite front, so a front aside from the popular front, wanted to establish libertarian communism. An anarcho-Trotskyite front wanted libertarian communism. Yeah. And I'm like, what?
These are
like so in the middle of a war?
Yeah, yeah. No, people do that all the time. Like it's like, people, I've seen, we've read the history. You know the people, like, people will...
Pop off some crazy shit.
Yeah.
In my mind.
It is like, this is the worst time to be doing this.
No.
But, like, this is the worst time to be doing this.
Yes.
And, but, like, you know, people have different ideas. So they're just like, look, let's get it going this way.
Right now,
because people want to get there. They want to realize their ideas. I mean, look, people have different objectives.
That's the time.
Is this a bad time for this objective? Oh yeah, no, you got Franco in the Luftwaffe on the
ass. I think you
got
to do
kind of chill out and let's get this thing won first.
Being,
but
like,
then
externally invaded by other countries and shit. And there's also like a revolution already underway by somebody who's going to be
brutal,
to suppress you once they can. Like, you got a much larger fish to fry. Like, now's the time to try to pop off this revolution in Barcelona. Like, that's kind of crazy. You know, I'm like,
look, that people have different objectives. People want to try to get the shit popping. I would say it was crazier, but I've seen it. I've seen people go like, I mean, we've read the history of being like, of people just like in of all political stripes, just trying to get some stuff going. It's like, now,
come on, man.
Now. Like, so
now's the time. It also kind of reads like, oh, you guys aren't communist enough. You guys aren't the real communists. And it's like, okay, cool, dude.
That's their literal. Right. They're just trying to do it now.
You're hipper than us. I get it. It's cool, man. You don't have to show off and fucking ruin the war. Okay, so what happens as a result of the uprising in Catalonia? The PCE has to divert forces to suppress the uprising in Catalonia, while Franco topples the industrial rich north, because they've got a bunch of factories and a bunch of resources up there, and now he has he's conquered them. He's got dominion over them. He's able to utilize them. He's robbed the left of those. Ibaruri says in her autobiography, she mentions the transmission or like a document or a letter sent from the ambassador to Franco, Germany's ambassador to Franco, this guy, Wilhelm Falpel. He sends a dispatch to Hitler basically saying that Franco's guys were the ones responsible for starting the riot. Like, he had some provocateurs and saboteurs inside Barcelona that popped this shit off as a false flag in order to divert forces away from the north. That way Franco could topple it. I've also heard that that Stalin is the one who orchestrated it. And this is just from Wikipedia. This isn't from Ibaruri's autobiography or Payne for that matter.
Yeah.
That they wanted to annihilate the POUM, which was kind of Trotsky-ish, and Trotsky, I think he's in exile at this point, and they're trying to annihilate any safe haven that he might have. So,
yeah,
competing ideas of what's going on.
Yeah. So, well, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Closing out the war, trying to get through it. The summer of 1937 to summer of 1938, there are attempted counteroffensives from the Republican forces, most notably, I think, at Teruel, which is kind of east. It's like northeastern Spain. It's attacked by the Republican forces to distract Franco from approaching Madrid from another angle, but on February 22nd of 1938, Teruel falls, and Ibaruri mentions the defense minister Indalecio Prieto's refusal to reinforce it because the government didn't take these threats as seriously as the 5th Regiment and the people on the front line did, naturally. But from Teruel, the reason I think it's important is because the nationalists are able to march east to the Mediterranean Sea, and so they cut off Catalonia entirely, which again was like Republican and sympathetic to the left, and so they split the territorial holdings that Republican Spain has in half, and so now he can divide and conquer. You know, March 16th to 18th in 1938, there's the bombing of Barcelona by Italian planes, which is ordered by Mussolini over Franco's head. Like, Franco doesn't give his consent, but Mussolini does it anyway, which is actually the worst bombing of the war by either side, not Guernica, just Guernica happened first. And then April of 1938, there's a new Republican government that is formed. They announce the 13 points. One of their stipulations is they call for, like, a national unity government. And they would include the right in this government if they wanted to, like, basically retry democracy. But mm-hmm. others of those 13 points are basically socialist talking points, basically about, like, land reform and whatnot. Yeah. And the nationalist governments basically say, no, we can afford to hold out. Like, we can yeah. afford not to participate in this. You know, we're doing okay.
We might actually win this thing. So let's kind of just, they're like fascists. Like, we might actually pull a hold out and get a little bit better.
We're okay, man. We're good.
We might get all our fascist dreams. Yeah. We just hold on out.
We don't need to concede to your 13 points. We've got our own 100 that we'll implement once we win. And
one of those points is somebody with a uniform shooting you. So, that's one of the points.
We're going to pass, big dog. Yeah. We're going to pass. It's all right.
Yeah.
July 1938 to March of 1939, this is the conclusion of the war. The Ebro River in northeastern Spain, kind of like near the border with France, is crossed by the Republican forces called the Army of the Ebro. It's like a last-ditch effort to support Catalonia, and it's one of the last, like, really difficult battles. Ibarruri says that Germany finally uses its heavy artillery to repel the Republican forces. The international brigades withdraw from Spain in November of 38. They, like, the last big thing that Ibarruri mentions that the Republican forces try to do is they assault Granada. Yeah. And that begins, like, around the same time as the collapse of the Catalonian front. So, like, December 38, January 1939. By late March of 1939, there's, like, another revolt under Colonel Segismundo Casado, and he basically just hands the government over to Franco because the socialists and the anarchists viewed the war as over, but the communists kind of wanted to still hold out. And then Casado revolts, he takes control of the government, and he basically hands it over to Franco. Primary errors made by the left and why Franco and the nationalists won this war is they didn't mobilize or utilize their fleet, really. That there was some, they might have had more sympathy amongst the Navy, but they just didn't really coordinate with it. The nationalists received better aid from Germany and Italy, but more to the point, they were not as united primarily, or like, this is a revolt from the right, from the military, and they're mostly in lockstep as far as what they need to achieve, where you've got like revolutions in Catalonia and three different leftist sects that the kind of like fractures the left and makes them not as strong as the right.
Yeah. I mean, the military is like, they're literally following orders in there. Like some, they literally, that's what the whole thing is order.
yeah. That's kind of, they build that whole shit around, and you know, you got dudes who are just like, during the revolution in Catalonia, like there's a proclamation from the anarchists where they're like, we're anarchists, right? And so we don't really believe in like military formations or military discipline or anything like that, because we're anarchists and that kind of goes against everything that we kind of fucking believe in, man. And so we don't believe in military.
Wait,
it's like, okay, hold up.
Is this in Payne?
This is in Ibarruri. Ibarruri says that the anarchists say, we're good on military formations,
That's how you're not really bad at it. That's how you lose a war.
That's how you lose. That's exactly how you lose a war. You're crazy. You could, like, come on, guys.
No, you could do like guerrilla warfare, but within guerrilla warfare, it's an extremely well planned military operation.
Nah, we're good, man. We're just gonna kind of manifest this revolution, bro. We don't need to plan it.
Yeah,
we're just gonna do it, man.
Yeah, that's how you lose.
That's exactly how you lose. I think. 1939 to 1960, getting into the like final, you know, last stretch. Ibarruri is in exile in Moscow. Her son Ruben dies fighting in Stalingrad as on the side of the Russians. She's broadcasting on Radio España Independiente, kind of speaking out against Franco and everything. The Secretary General of the PCE dies in 1942, so she assumes that role.
Yeah.
And then from there, her and or presumably her and Santiago Carrillo, they start conducting an internal purge of the PCE from 1947 to 1951. And this is according to Enrique Lister, who is like one of the leftist commanders during the war. Like he was at Ebro and all this stuff. So it's not like this is a, this is coming from the inside, which, you know, take that with what you will.
All the grains of salt.
Take all the grains of salt that are the conglomerates of salt throughout this episode.
Take them grains, right? And salt them.
And also, like, for the rest of her life, she's writing and advocating for world communism. She's working closely with the Comintern. She's traveling around. In 1960, she retires as Secretary General of the PCE. She starts writing her memoirs, one of which, No Pasarán, or They Shall Not Pass, is translated into English. And that's the only one, unfortunately. Like, she has others that she's written in Spanish. However, the one that I read focuses primarily on the war, which is why this episode focused primarily on the war, because that's the source material. My Spanish is okay. I'm not at the point where I can read the memoirs.
From your voice, we all can tell that you cannot read Spanish fluently. We understand, and nobody thought you could.
Thank you. I was worried, man.
No, nobody expecting you to read Spanish.
She's traveling around for like the rest of her life. She speaks at Nikita Khrushchev's birthday before he's ousted in like 1964. So she's like up there with the big dogs, you know what I mean? Yeah. 1977, 2 years after the death of Franco, she's able to return to Spain, and she's still speaking to like massive throngs of people at age 82. Like, she commands a lot of respect as a public figure and an orator. She is iconic in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
She takes a seat in Congress, and she votes yes for a new constitution. However, she's kind of dogged by, like, health issues. It isn't until November 12th of 1989 that she dies of pneumonia at the age of 93.
Any thoughts on the life of Iribarri? And any thoughts?
It was interesting. I had no idea what I was getting into, man.
Yeah, man. The Spanish Civil War is something that I've always heard of, but as an aside, never really have, still don't understand. Gonna say that.
No, hell no.
Still don't have, a firm grasp on Spain in the '30s. I'm gonna say that for sure.
There's a lot.
But I think it's been it's been interesting.
Yeah. That's kind of my regret is that, again, the only biography of Otto or otherwise available on her in English is They Shall Not Pass, and she talks about the war the entire time. So I regret that she's probably like a two-parter, and somebody should write a biography if they haven't about her life as a whole, because I'm sure she had hella hot takes on Vietnam and Yugoslavia and all sorts of other shit going on.
All them hot takes.
She was like right in it, you know, in it. And there's a lot of interesting history there. And as far as like the Spanish Civil War itself, you touched on it earlier that it's more of a proxy war. There's a tendency to think that it was the first battle of World War II, in which case, like what Bleeding Kansas was for the Civil War, Spanish Civil War would be to World War II.
Yeah.
But what Payne says is he's like a more accurate framework given the support both sides received is that it was like the first battle of the Cold War.
But then that would put
make the U.S. the fascist.
That would make U.S. the fascist.
Which,
I mean, if we're going to align that. Oof, oof. Oof.
I don't know.
Oh, Payne had a hot take at the end?
I don't know, man. He snuck it in.
Did Payne have a hot take at the end? He was trying to get off?
He did, man.
All right, my man. Yeah, no, it's a... Yeah, I thought that was going a different place, and now that came up with a new hot take.
Mm-hmm.
So, woo, okay,
all right, maybe, you know,
guys, that's been our episode. Guys, we want to thank you for listening. Who are we doing next week?
Next week, oh my God, I am so excited for next week, and I hope you are too. We are talking about the Bandit Queen of India, Poolan Devi. Guys, okay. A very powerful story. She's really okay. Cool.
Yeah, man. And so, if you guys want to thank you again for listening to our episode on Dolores Ibaruri. Ibaruri, I can't say the word. Dolores Ibaruri. Ibaruri, I can't do R's.
Like roll those that. R's, bro.
I can't roll. All right, guys. Guys, please follow us and listen to and like and follow us on all social media platforms. Hardfire History on Instagram and Facebook, HFH Podcast on Twitter, Hardfire History on YouTube. Follow me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter, Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Henry, where can they find you at?
You find me, Henry E. Price on Instagram, just Henry Price on Facebook.
Guys, we love you. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please come back, tell your friends, your family, everybody. And we'll see you guys next time.
That's all right.
Peace.